Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, how you doing? And welcome to the show this week. And due to popular demand, we've decided to replay some of our favorite interviews and segments from the last several months here on the Kelly Alexander Show. It's been so much fun to wade through our archives and pull out the pieces that you've asked to hear one more time. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy listening to these amazing guests, as well as our wild segments that we've had so much fun to put together for you right here on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
If you're a fan of both daytime and nighttime television, you are going to know exactly who I'm talking about when I mention the characters of Dr. Maria Santos from All My Children and Detective Natalia Boavista from CSI Miami. That's right. The common denominator is that both these characters are portrayed by the amazing actress Eva LaRue. Eva, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much.
Eva, now, I have to ask you, was it a goal to be an actress since you were a kid? Because I always wonder where this sort of seed starts.
You know, it really was. I think from the time I can remember, at about 4 or 5 years old, I was always the one in the neighborhood gathering together all my friends and putting on a show. And the show would move from living room to living room. So we were on a road tour of the neighborhood, with our little, you know, show.
The traveling show.
It was a traveling show, traveling circus show. And so I knew I wanted to be an entertainer. I always loved the triple threats in the business, the Shirley MacLaines and the Liza Minnellis and the people who could sing, act, and dance. And that's really what I always wanted to do.
Was it a wild ride for you to get the gig on All My Children? Because I know for a lot of people, All My Children is like the epitome of the soap genre.
Yeah, it was. It was, well, I had done Santa Barbara before that for about a year. And then I was born and raised in Southern California. So when I got the job on All My Children, it meant moving to New York, picking up and moving to New York. And I was 23 at the time, but I did it and it ended up being the best thing I ever did in my life. And I have to tell you, after hearing that All My Children might be canceled, I cried so hard for about a day and a half because it was such a part of my adulthood. I mean, I feel like I grew up there on the show. I had dinner with Kelly Ripa and Mark Consuelos last week when I was in New York, and we were talking about it, and they said the same thing because, you know, they met there, got married there, had Michael, their first baby there. And, you know, I met my ex-husband there, John Callahan, and had my baby there. And, you know, it was just so much a part of our lives. And it's been on the air for 41 years, mm-hmm. And it's just such an iconic show. I can't imagine it not being on the air. And it's something that has been a part of so many generations. I grew up watching it with my mom, and my daughter watches it sometimes now with me when she's home sick from school, of course. And people ask me all the time, do you actually watch the show? And I said, yeah, I watch the show at least twice a week. I have to check in and see what my friends are doing.
That's awesome. And I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I've had the opportunity to interview several soap actors in the past, and recently Sean Kanan from Young and the Restless, and also Eileen Davidson a few months ago from Young and the Restless. And at that time when I spoke to Eileen, you know, the word had not come down yet that All My Children and One Life to Live was sort of, you know, going down the wayside there. But, you know, I remember when I got into soaps hardcore in the early 90s, you know, there was like 12 or 16 of them. And now there's going to be 4. So do you
there's
feel...
There's going to be 4, and they're saying that this is going to be the last year of the daytime Emmys.
Oh, I didn't even hear that. So that's news.
Yeah,
to me.
That's what they're... I mean, that's the rumor right now. Because,
wow.
Well, what would they really have to...
Compete.
You know, what's best show if there's only 4 shows?
Right. And so do you feel like the other 4 that are going to be left, like General Hospital, Young and the Restless, Bold and the Beautiful, Days of Our Lives, do you feel they're in danger of also becoming obsolete?
Well, they've been talking about Days of Our Lives being on the chopping block for, you know, just about every year for the past 5 or 6 years, I think. So I don't know what kind of shape they're in at the moment, or if that's still the going rumor. But, I mean, can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
It would end up being 3?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's really sad to see the end of an era go. And I just really feel like there's still an audience for
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and something that Eileen mentioned, and I wanted to get your take on it, is Eileen had mentioned, because as you know, she's been on soaps for many years, and she said that, you know, originally back in the 80s and 90s, you know, soaps, the storylines that they were telling were really breaking new ground. Like, they were the first ones to cover, you know, interracial marriages or, you know, homosexual storylines. But now she feels like with the internet and everything, like, so much is being broken online before it even makes it to television. And she sort of feels, if, you know, to paraphrase her, it feels like that's why there's been a bit of a decline. Do you feel like that's sort of the reason as well, that soaps are kind of falling by the wayside, that they're not the first anymore with the storylines?
Well, I think not only that, but we've got so much reality TV that we can see that more ridiculous things happen. I mean, here people used to always say, oh, it's ridiculous what goes on soap operas. Not really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, tune in to an episode of The Jersey Shore and you'll see that not necessarily is it that crazy. So, you know, I think people are would rather watch the comings and goings of these other people and on reality shows than you know, watch daytime anymore.
Okay. And when you were, you know, in the thick of it, and you know, it was always said that you were a part of the super couple with your ex-husband John Callahan, Edmund and Maria. Was there a lot of pressure on you when that was going on? Was it sort of surreal to be in this super, this power couple that was going on?
Yeah, it really was. And I remember at one point, you know, we didn't realize that it was happening. And we went to one of those super soap weekends that the ABC daytime people go to once a year. And it was at Disney World every year. And it was really fun. We'd go for 4 days and it would be a chance to meet all the fans. And it was really a blast. You felt like Elvis, felt like a rock star for 4 days. And we went and we saw these huge posters of us everywhere. And we kind of looked at each other and we're like, oh my God, we're a super couple. We actually made it into that echelon of couples were considered a super couple. I remember very specifically us having that conversation, like, oh my God, we did it.
And it's hard to do it because there's only a few of you that have actually managed to have that, you know, fan following.
But we didn't think that we were until we saw all these big, you know, posters of ourselves together everywhere. And we're like, oh my gosh, that's us.
And I know it's been a while since you've been on the soap canvas full time, but I'm assuming that you must have an ardent following still from your soap days.
You know, it's interesting because we have, they say, 20 million viewers for CSI Miami, which is so many more viewers than tune in to All My Children on a daily basis. But I think because All My Children ran for so long and I was associated with the show off and on for 10 years, I still, more people than ever come up and say, oh, I used to love you and All My Children. More people will talk to me about All My Children than ever talk to me about CSI Miami.
Wow.
Still, now.
And it's going to follow you forever, which is probably fine with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, which is awesome because the character, I loved the character and I loved the show and I loved my experience there.
And was it hard for you to leave,
associated with that show? I actually am lobbying to go back.
Oh yeah, good.
To do some episodes this summer before the show goes off the air. And I already told CSI that that it's what I want to do and they've given me the thumbs up. And I really, really want to be part of that last month of the show.
And before I jump into CSI, I just wanted to ask you, when you actually sort of left All My Children full time, was it hard for you to jump? Because it's almost like leaving all your high school friends, I would imagine.
Oh, it absolutely was. It was like leaving high school and you know, going off to college alone. You know, it was really, really hard to walk out that door.
Joining us on the show is actress Eva LaRue, who plays Detective Natalia Boavista on CSI Miami, and who also had a very successful run as Dr. Maria Santos on All My Children. Make sure to check out her website, evalarue.com. Now, as we mentioned, for the last several years, you've played this wonderful character on CSI Miami, Detective Natalia Boavista. Now, what's it been like as an actress portraying your character's growth on the show? Because it seems like you've come from point A, and you're definitely passing point B and into point C now.
This last year was really, really exciting for me. Emily Proctor got pregnant in real life, and so she had a beautiful baby girl back in December. And she decided to take it easy towards those last couple of months, and I got an opportunity to really what ended up being funny is I ended up being sort of the resident victim. I can't even tell you how many times I got kidnapped or, you know, hijacked or what this season, but it was really fun. I got to do a whole lot more running and jumping and shooting and playing and doing and, you know, madness. And so it was really an exciting season.
And do you enjoy being involved in like the stunt stuff? Like, is it fun to be out there and sort of like you said, running and tumbling around?
Yeah, it really is. It's really exciting.
And I know that you have a lot of technical jargon to get through on the show. Was it hard, I guess, when, you know, the first couple seasons having to learn all this technical stuff that a lot of us have no clue what you're saying anyway?
Oh my gosh. You know what? So many times I'm like, do I really, is anybody going to know what this is? Can it, please let me skip this word. It's the worst part of the job. I love my job, but the worst part of it is I feel like speaking in Chinese. I feel like it is speaking in a language that you don't know and will never really understand what you're saying. And that is by far the hardest thing for all of us on the show, is the science speak portion of it.
And a question for you, because I think a lot of people don't really understand what it's like to be a part of, you know, like a huge network show like CSI Miami. Can you just give us like a typical idea of your day when you're on set? Like if you are full on busy that day, like what time do you have to get up and how does the day sort of run?
The day is always different. So depending on how big your storyline is for that episode, it takes 9 days to shoot an episode. And there are 7 of us. So we all work about... on average, we all work about 4 days an episode. But this last season, I worked more like 6, 7, 8 days an episode. So it was a lot more busy for me this year than it normally is. But it's really a lovely schedule. We work a 12-hour day. We're not like a lot of nighttime drama, you know, 1-hour dramas where they work an 18-hour day or you know, a lot of shows that my friends are working on, they call them fratter days, because it's your day starts on Friday and ends on Saturday morning at 6 a.m. And so your weekend's shot because, you know, they're exhausted and
right,
sleeping through the day. We don't have that kind of schedule at all. We have a great 12-hour day. So, you know, I have to get to work at about 6 a.m. And then it pretty much ends at 7.
And yeah. When you're on set, you know, do you have time to get, because I just know by watching you that you're obviously a very active person. When there's a bit of downtime on the set, is that when you get your workout in?
No, because otherwise you get all sweaty and you've got to go through makeup and hair again and everybody's mad at you. And there's never really quite enough time in between scenes to, you know,
okay,
get changed, work out and come back. So that is when it's hard to, you know, when you've got heavy storyline and try to squeeze it in, because, you know, you don't want to get up at 3 in the morning and work out before you have to leave for it.
Wow.
So, and then at the end of the day, you know, I want to spend time with my daughter when I get home and put her to bed and have some family time. So I try to do it on my days off, and then I squeeze it in on the weekends as well.
Okay, gotcha. Now, I have to ask you this as well. Being a part of this, you know, crazy, I guess we'll call it franchise of CSI, you know, you're on CSI Miami. Are you guys, like, as a team from CSI Miami, you know, a little bit competitive with your counterparts, you know, from CSI and CSI New York? Because I keep thinking that you guys all sit there, watch the ratings, and see who comes out on top all the time.
No, we aren't. I mean, I guess maybe we're all crosstown rivals or sibling rivals, but we don't keep track of what everybody's up to.
Okay.
We really don't. We see each other at you know, charity events and parties and things like that, and everybody's obviously really friendly, and everybody gets along great, But no, we don't really keep track of each other.
Okay. Now, I know that the season finale of CSI Miami, you know, it was just broadcast, and your character was in a very sort of sticky situation at the end. I know you can't sort of tell us what ends up happening, but just a question for you. Do they let you know as an actress what's going to happen, or are you in the dark during hiatus as well?
I am in the dark during hiatus as well. We're in the dark pretty much all the time until the script comes out the week that we're shooting it.
Oh, wow.
So we have no idea what's going on for our month. We get our scripts as the new episode starts, and that's the first that we know of it. And then I guess we shoot about a month ahead of what you guys see, so we know about a month, you know, ahead of what you guys are viewing on TV.
Okay. And now, obviously, you guys are in hiatus now. When would you guys go back? July? Is that how that works?
We do. We go back second week in July, and then we start to air in September.
Joining us on the show right now is actress Eva LaRue, who plays Detective Natalia Boavista on CSI Miami. Check her out, evalarue.com. Now, Eva, something I've been wanting to ask you, you know, for a couple years now, because I've seen it sort of all over the place. You're very involved, I guess, in the realm of cancer, if I can call it that. I wanted to ask you about, I guess, your latest involvement, which seems to be with the Beckstrand Cancer Foundation. Can you tell us why you're involved? And I know that cancer has like a personal connection to you and your family.
It does. I was doing a lot of work with the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition for a few years because my grandmother and my great-grandmother both died from ovarian cancer. And then I was doing some work with various research coalitions and awareness, cancer awareness coalitions, which are all very important. But when a friend of mine died from breast cancer 4 years ago, it was the first time that I realized or saw firsthand how absolutely financially devastating cancer could be. And this was a friend of mine from high school. So towards the end, we were doing, she's a school teacher, and she's married to a friend of mine from junior high, and he's a school teacher, and she had not been unable to work for the last couple of years. So we were doing all of these fundraisers, you know, pancake breakfasts and spaghetti dinners and things like that to help pay their mortgage. Because once you've gone through all of the traditional treatments that are covered by your medical insurance, the experimental treatments aren't. And, you know, one of the pills alone that she was having to take five times a day was $33 a pill.
Oh, my God.
Five times a day. I mean, that's just one. You know, it's just unbelievable how expensive cancer can be. And if you don't have that, you don't have that second income, who's helping you pay your mortgage? Who is helping you with your groceries and your phone bill and your electric bill and your, you know, all of these things? So I was introduced to Beckstrand Cancer Foundation, and they come in, they are only regional, they're in Southern California, but I just became their national spokesperson for their scholarship program. So they come in and they provide scholarships for kids who have cancer or who have had cancer, because now, you know, a lot of times the parents have had to mortgage their house to help keep this child alive, and now there's no money to send them to college. So the national part of the program is the scholarship program. The regional part of the program here in Southern California literally comes in and helps them with everything. One of my friends from high school, her daughter has leukemia. They just started paying her house payment for the next 6 months. They come in, they give you food vouchers, they pay your electric bill, your phone bill, your rent, your whatever it is that you need for that 6 months that you're going through chemo and radiation and you can't work. They are unbelievable. They just jump right into the trenches and help you out.
And how can people help, like, get involved with this organization?
Well, if you're in Southern California and you need the help, go to Beckstrand.org. If you can help and you want to donate to Beckstrand, that's even more brilliant, because certainly there's so many people that need help. Or if you want to help and donate to the National College Scholarship Program at Beckstrand.org, that would also be amazing. So you can help in myriad ways.
And I wanted to ask you, because, you know, I have a lot of female listeners that listen to this program, and, you know, women, soccer moms, professionals, all that sort of stuff. Everybody's got a very busy life going on. But I know that, you've been very involved in the ovarian cancer and the breast cancer. What do you say to my working moms about taking care of themselves and making sure, you know, everything's up to par?
You know, you really have to be your own health advocate. I think that we put far too much trust in our first line of defense, which is our doctors. But I think that we blindly trust going in and they say, oh, I checked you out and you seem to be fine. And we go home and say, well, we're fine. Doctor said that we're fine. But you know in your gut that something's wrong. We all know when something's wrong, because it's a persistent ache or pain or bloating, or you just know that something's not right, or you're fatigued in some way. Go and get a second opinion. Go to another doctor. Don't wait 6 months to do it, because it could be the difference between life and death. It could be the difference between a small growth and a large growth, between first stage and third stage. Go and get a second opinion. You have to be your own health advocate.
Eva, now, before I let you go, I have to ask you what's up next for you, because I think it's just fantastic that you spend so much time trying to help out with, this whole cancer situation and the various forms, and now with Beckstrand. What's up next for you with regards to this and also professionally?
Right now we're on hiatus, which is amazing. We're gearing up to go on a big family vacation to Africa for 3 weeks with the kids, and I cannot tell you how excited I am about that. We're going to go on the Great Migration and go to Kenya and Tanzania and Zanzibar. So I am insanely excited about that. And then we go back to work second week in July, And that's and right now, unfortunately, we had a lot of rains in Southern California about a month ago, and I ended up with so much damage to my house that I have no living room at the moment because my entire living room floor is pulled up. And and my whole backyard is jackhammered because they are so we're in a construction zone at the moment, and but it ended up being perfect timing because I'm on hiatus and my husband, who owns a commercial fishing company, he's on his hiatus at the moment, so we can pool our efforts and our focus and do all the house stuff that we need to do before we both go back to work.
Good for you. Well, Eva, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's actress Eva LaRue again, who plays Detective Natalia Boavista on CSI Miami. Check her out for sure at her website, www.evalarue.com.
What's impossible, will they forget? This world keeps spinning, and with each new day I can feel a change in everything. And as the surface breaks, reflections fade, but in some ways they remain the same. And as my mind begins to spread its wings, there's no stopping curiosity. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. We'll sing and dance to Mother Nature's songs. I don't want this feeling to go away. I can't do everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. We'll sing and dance. This world keeps spinning and there's no time to waste. Well, it all keeps spinning, spinning round and round and upside down. Who's to say what's impossible and can't be found? I don't want this feeling to go away. Please don't go away. Please don't go away. Please don't go away. Is this how it's supposed to be? Is this how it's supposed to be?
It's hard to believe, but one of the leaders in social media has just turned 5. Happy birthday, Twitter. And whether you use it or not, you can't deny that this tool has totally become a cultural phenomenon. We all know that tweeting doesn't mean we're whistling at the birds. To give us an idea of just how important Twitter is and how it's evolved in the last 5 years is public relations expert and professor of strategic communications at the Mayborn School of Journalism at the University of North Texas, Samra Bufkins. Samra, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
Samra, for people who don't know, how did Twitter sort of get its start, and what was its purpose supposed to be at the outset?
Twitter actually started out as an internal communications tool with a bunch of guys, of course, out in Silicon Valley, and it was about 5 years ago, and it was a quick and dirty way for them to communicate with each other, and 140 characters is the limit, so it's just a quick message, and it was quicker than text messaging, and it was kind of on a closed network, and eventually they saw the potential to make it be more of a public vehicle, and I think a lot of us kind of wonder what the point was at first. I'll admit that I've really only been using Twitter extensively for about 2 years because I'm one of those people that didn't get it either. I just didn't see the point.
And were there a lot of naysayers in the beginning? Because I'm sure a lot of people, you know, thought that a tool that would only let you spit out 140 characters, you know, would not last over the long term.
There were a lot of naysayers at the beginning, and as recently as a year and a half ago, my department chairman here at the university, who's an advertising professor, said, oh, Twitter's a fad, it'll be gone in a year. Last fall, she said, we have got to be teaching a social media class, you need to start putting one together. So I'm teaching the first social media class this semester. I use Twitter in all of my classes as a means of communicating with students, and a lot of them started out as skeptics too, and now they're sold on it. So I think the best way to find out if it works for you and find out its usefulness is to actually use it.
In your view, how has Twitter evolved in the last 5 years? And I guess who has benefited the most from it apart from, you know, the Silicon Valley creators?
Well, over the last 5 years, Twitter, it started out really as kind of a pointless means of keeping in touch. People said, I'm walking the dog. I'm at Starbucks. I'm picking the kids up in the carpool line. Really pointless stuff that most of us didn't care about. For me, I didn't care anything about Twitter. I had gone to a class and I had a Twitter account. I never tweeted. And then the plane landed in the Hudson River. And we've all seen that twit pic of those people standing on the wings waiting to be rescued. And it's taken by a guy with a cell phone on the boat that's going to rescue them. And I thought, there's some value here. And the use of Twitter varies from person to person. I use it for following breaking news. Of course, I communicate with my students. I follow media. I follow other PR professionals and also other PR professors. And we share ideas. It has evolved into a major marketing tool. A lot of companies are using it to market to their customers in very subtle ways. And then, to me, one of the most valuable ways is as a customer service tool, because it really opens up the channels of conversation between a company and its customers.
That's a fascinating viewpoint. And I guess following along with that, and I was going to ask you this later, but I, because you've brought it up, I want to ask it now. With regards to celebrities, you know, there's so many of us that follow celebrities. And for an example, it hasn't been that long that Christina Aguilera has launched her Twitter account. Now, she had 35,000 followers before she'd even put out one tweet. As I was following her in that sort of first 24-hour cycle of her, you know, having this Twitter account, in one sort of two-hour span, she collected more than 9,000 followers. And by the time that sort of first day was done of 24 hours of her being on Twitter, she had amassed 135,000 followers. Now, for someone like her, for someone like Charlie Sheen, who used that, it seems, to his advantage in the last, you know, month or so, what do you think about that? Do you think that celebrities are totally benefiting from this because they can, you know, respond to their fans immediately, confirm or deny, you know, scenarios or situations that are being bandied about by media that, you know, may or may not be true?
Well, I think they are, because that's part of their personal brand. A celebrity name is a brand, and it's their personal brand. And for them to stay alive in this business, I'm not talking about breathing alive, but for them to stay alive in the public consciousness, they need to be out there. Britney Spears and Ashton Kutcher have more followers than, I can't remember the list, I should have had it in front of me, but it's something like 7 or 8 countries, and they're fairly large countries. I think for a celebrity, it's a good way to keep your name out there, especially if you're not making a lot of movies or making a lot of records right now. And people are really fascinated with celebrity lives. So if it's a celebrity you really like, follow them on Twitter. Make sure you're following the real one and not the fake one.
through those the verified accounts.
Yes, the verified accounts for sure.
And you know, on the flip side of this, there are celebrities who have screwed up by using Twitter. And through the recent Japanese earthquake, we've seen that because, for example, the rapper 50 Cent said some pretty bad comments, and that came around to sort of bite him in the butt. I know that there's some other celebrities that said some things and immediately were chastised. So it's a delicate balance.
It certainly is. And the other thing that I'm always cautioning my students is anything you put out there in cyberspace, it's out there forever. I mean, the United States Library of Congress is archiving tweets. Every tweet that's ever been sent out on Twitter is going into the Library of Congress. And 100 years from now, somebody's going to look at this stuff and go, whoa, what were they doing? So that's important. You can put something out there and think before you tweet. We say that about email. It's even more important about Twitter now because it is so public.
And you're right, because I was just following an entertainment story earlier this week. And, for example, there was two of them actually that cropped up, but I'll use the one regarding James Franco and the Oscars, because I know a lot of people were sort of unhappy with his efforts hosting the Oscars or co-hosting the Oscars. And anyway, he sort of found out, I guess, through the grapevine, or I think it even may have been a tweet from one of the Oscar writers, Bruce Valanche, who basically said that, you know, James had so much going on prior to the Oscars that he really didn't sort of commit and had a short amount of time to get his act together, and then it didn't work out. So James got a hold of this or found out through the grapevine about this, and then he immediately tweeted a picture of him and Bruce, this writer from the Oscar committee, from the Oscars, and sort of put that out on his Twitter. But he'd written on top of it basically not a nice message, and using a word that I can't even really use here right now. But he thought better of it, you know, and I think within an hour or so he'd taken it down. But by that point, someone had taken a snapshot and it was all over the media. So
right. And that stuff gets forwarded and forwarded again. And that's what you call going viral.
Exactly. Exactly. So there is a balance for sure. Joining us on the show is public relations expert and professor of strategic communications at the Mayborn School of Journalism at the University of North Texas, Samra Bufkins. Samra, you know, we were talking earlier about the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan. It seems like Twitter became super useful in the immediate hours following and days following this event.
Twitter has become super useful in a lot of disasters. The Haiti earthquake was another example. Just the other day, I think it was yesterday, there was an aftershock in Japan and people were tweeting about it. So you're hearing about it from the people who are experiencing it before you hear about it from the news media. A good example around here, I'm in Texas, and of course 2 years ago we had Hurricane Ike that really did a lot of damage in Houston. People were using Twitter during that time to tweet about, oh, this particular home repair store has power and they have generators and they have roofing material and they're open. And they would tweet that, and people would go to that store, or they'd tweet a particular gas station is open and has gasoline, because they went several weeks there with no power in the fourth largest city in the United States. So Twitter can become a really important means of people touching base with each other and letting them know useful information. It's very useful in disasters.
And do you think that, you know, the different generations, because, you know, there's so many people now that are becoming computer savvy, and I should say social media savvy. Do you think that Twitter is a social media tool for all ages?
I think it is, and I've seen statistics that the average age of people on Twitter is 39.
Wow.
Yes.
That's
and
older than
fastest,
I thought.
The fastest growing demographic on Facebook is women 55 to 65. So all of these technologies are maturing. What I'm finding in teaching it with my students is a lot of them never really knew how to use it strategically. And what I tell them is the value in Twitter is in who you follow. I have twice as many people following me as I follow. I don't know who most of those people are. They've found something about me that's interesting and they want to hear my or get my tweets. But what you need to do is choose people to follow or organizations to follow that are tweeting information interesting to you.
And I find that's such an important point, because speaking from experience as a radio announcer who needs to be up on sort of current affairs and entertainment affairs and all that sort of stuff, you know, I'm finding out things quicker than I would have had I was, you know, because TMZ, for example, very quick at getting, you know, celebrity news out. I find now if you're following, you know, X amount of celebrities or some, you know, specific A-list celebrities, you're finding out the news before TMZ is getting it to you, which is kind of incredible.
Exactly, exactly. And if and it's, you know, and it's not all about celebrity PR. My husband and I were at a an NCAA basketball tournament watch party on Saturday afternoon, and during a commercial break, I pulled out my phone, checked Twitter, and that's how I knew we were bombing Libya.
Wow. You know, and it's interesting that you brought that up, because my other point would be, you know, we talked about the TMZ, but then, you know, CNN used to be the place that I would go to, at least the website, if something was going on. And now I find it's not the place to be. It is Twitter. Like, I found out about the Japanese earthquake or the, you know, because of Twitter.
Yeah, so did I.
Okay. So it's definitely turning into this media tool that is just really making the world a much smaller place then.
Right. And, you know, and if I'm having a totally crazy day on a day when I teach a bunch of classes and I've got kids running in and out and there's a newspaper laying over there and I haven't had time to look at it yet, but I've got my Twitter feed up. I run on TweetDeck all the time, and then I can follow several different things at once. And I highly recommend Twitter skeptics to use a third-party platform like TweetDeck or Hootsuite, where you can follow multiple Twitter feeds at once, and you know, you're not staring at it all day. I've just got it out the corner of my eye. I can see it, and I'll see the breaking news feed jump up, and I'll always look at that because that's bright red. But the whole point of this is find what you're interested in, and it will come to you. The information is seeking you out.
I guess another question that I wanted to sort of bring your way, the two main social media tools, and I know there's many, but I think the two big guns are totally Twitter and Facebook. What are your thoughts on the two of them? And is it really apples and oranges, or is one better than the other? Like, what's your thoughts?
Well, I wouldn't say one is better than the other, because they have complementary functions. And both are not for everybody. I personally use my Facebook more as personal stuff. It's a way of sharing information. I mean, I have friends from high school 30 years ago who we're on Facebook. We've reconnected, and so we kind of keep up with each other's lives. Students will friend me on Facebook, especially after they graduate. I love that when they graduate, and then I can keep up with them, what they're doing. To me, Facebook is more about a slower, more long-term conversation type of thing, places where you can post a whole photo album or videos, and it's almost like your own little personal website of your life. But it's being used by marketers as well to communicate with people and to keep a conversation going between a company and its customers. Twitter is very immediate. It's 140 characters. It's like a headline. Every time you send a tweet, it's a headline. And it's an attention-grabbing headline. I use it with my students where I will put a link to an article or a blog that I want them to read. When they blog, and all my students have to blog, when they update their blog, they tweet the link and say, "Updated my blog, it's about this." And people can follow that. We can click on it and read it right away. But to me, they're different. You can use Twitter over and over and over during a day. Most of the people that I talk to and some studies that I've seen is people do get annoyed if Facebook updates happen too much, too fast. It's kind of like Facebook, we're happy if you update once or twice a day, guys. Twitter, I want to hear from you.
That's actually, now that I think about it and take a third step back, I can see that. I can see that makes a lot of sense. And Samra, for people who, you know, want to embark on Twitterverse, as I call it, you know, it's not too late to join the party, as we just saw, speaking of Christina Aguilera. What would you suggest to people who, you know, want to start a Twitter account and you know, whether you're 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s?
Well, of course, the first thing you do is go to Twitter.com and set up an account. All you need is an email address and a computer, and you can upload a picture. You can do a little bit of a bio. It's going to be short. It's really good. I love it for my students. People say it makes them worse writers. It's making them better writers because they're more concise. Put up a little thing there, and then finding people to follow is the hard part. But there's a website called Twello, TWELLOW.com, and it's literally a combination of Twitter and the Yellow Pages. And you can go in there and set up a profile for yourself and click off about 10 different things that you're interested in. And then you can go find people that you're interested in and follow them. And the way I choose people to follow on Twitter is I go into their Twitter page, and you just click on these links. I'm completely self-taught on this. I've never read a book on it. I've never taken a class in it. But you just click on them, and I always say, look at their last 10 or 20 tweets. And if it's interesting, follow them. If after a while you realize, hey, we don't have anything in common, unfollow them. For example, right now during the NCAA basketball tournament, one of my teams is in it. I'm, you know, big fan. We tweet a lot during basketball games. And what's fun about that is a shared event. I'm tweeting with people from all over the world who are watching that basketball game, and it's like we're all sitting in the sports stadium together or the sports bar together. And same thing happens with things like the State of the Union address or a major event. It's like you're sitting in the same room with these people and sharing comments, but it's on Twitter. And but during a basketball game or the Oscars or something, you'll make some comments and you'll pick up followers. And then I'll notice maybe a week or so later they'll drop off because they suddenly realize that the only time I said anything interesting to them was during that event. And that's fine. It's all about the conversation. And you kind of drift in and out of conversations in the real world, and you can do it in Twitter too.
Samer, you've been awesome to speak to. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, anytime. I really enjoyed talking to you.
That's public relations expert and professor of strategic communications at the Mayborn School of Journalism at the University of North Texas, Samer Bufkins. Make sure to check her out on Twitter at SamJB. That's S-A-M-J-B.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
There are so many options, not to mention so many questions when it comes to wine and the art of pairing wine with your food. To help us navigate the sometimes overwhelming world of wine is food and wine expert and host of the web series Gastro Tommy, Tommy Powers. Tommy, thank you so much for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Tommy, first of all, how did you get into the field of gourmet food and wine? Because it sounds like quite the exciting career path.
I really started when I was about 16 years old. My older brother was just starting to collect wines, and his sagely advice was that girls like wine, so you should learn about it. And at 16, that was all I needed to know. But I quickly found that it was exactly where I wanted to live, and so I've really dedicated my entire adult life to food and wine.
Now, I think a lot of people, Tommy, are intimidated, you know, when it comes to the world of wine. We feel like it's above our comfort zone. It may be difficult for us to sort of pick the wrong wine. We're scared of picking the wrong wine if we're going to a dinner party or an event. What do you tell someone who's going to an event and who has no real clue about which type of wine to bring?
You know, the one thing that I recommend for everyone is to find a good store near you. And today, with the growth of the interest in wine in the United States, the level of education all over the country is tremendous. And I think that's really the best way to start to buy more effectively. But, you know, even if it is that last minute thing where you're taking a wine over to a party at a friend's house, to go in and let them know, you know, this is my friend, this is, you know, how many people, this is what they tend to like. And the people in the stores can do a wonderful job of recommending wines for them. I can tell you at every price point, and I mean that literally from $6 up, there are wines that are of very good quality now. So it really enables somebody to spend the amount of money that they're most comfortable with.
And what's your thoughts on Australian wine? Because for some reason in my life in the last couple of weeks, it just seems that Australian wine keeps popping up. Is that something that's sort of new and exciting?
You know, Australia is a country that I think was really hot 20 years ago and even 10 years ago. But because of the profound success they were having in the Asian markets and also in the United States, there were an inordinate amount of people who came in and started planting almost irresponsibly with no thought of, you know, what will the markets allow? How many grapes can we really produce successfully and sell? And what we saw over a period of time was that the markets in the United States changed, the market in England changed, and unfortunately the overall quality did not stay where it was, but unfortunately has dropped a little bit. So there is a wealth of grapes in Australia that they can't sell. And it's very sad because there's some really beautiful production there, even beyond, you know, that gross amount of production that increased.
And how are we doing in North America?
You know, I think it's probably the most exciting area, and I was remiss in not including, you know, what we're seeing in Canada, particularly in the Niagara Peninsula, but also, you know, in the United States. We're starting to see more and more wines coming out of Mexico, even in the Baja area. or even the part of Mexico. So I think the North American market is booming. There are more and more bright people coming to the playing field, and there's a wonderful sharing of ideas and technologies, and I think we'll see more emerging markets as we go forward. I think the thing that's most important is that as our palates have evolved and we're now starting to drink more balanced wines and not some of those hugely extracted, overblown, high alcohol, high oak wines, but we're seeing wines that have a little bit more restraint, a little bit more elegance, and are just better balanced.
Joining us on the line today is Tommy Powers from Chicago, and he's a food and wine expert and host of the web series Gastro Tommy. Please make sure you check him out at www.gastrotommy.com. Now, Tommy, sometimes I think people get stuck in a rut when it comes to the wine that they drink. You know, they found a brand that they like and they seem to stick with it. How do you get out of that and actually experiment again? Or is it people that are just scared of trying new things?
Well, you know, there's lots of options available to us. You know, I think the best way for anyone, and, you know, reading what the critics have to say is helpful. But that's only one palate, and it may not be the same as yours. So the best thing that people can do are find these tasting events that are all over North America now, and oftentimes at very, very good values. And that's a great opportunity for someone to go in and try 30, 50 wines in an afternoon. And what I'm always amazed at is how much people are surprised, you know, where they think, boy, I didn't think I liked Italian wines, or I didn't think I liked Spanish wines. And, you know, to say that an entire country doesn't produce anything you like would be, you know, inaccurate. So the other thing I can say is that in a lot of the good restaurants and wine bars, you can often just ask for a taste of something. And so I would say, you know, try varietals that are comparable. You know, go into that store and say, you know, I've been drinking Sauvignon Blanc, what else should I try? Or is there Sauvignon Blanc from a different part of the world that I might be interested in? But, you know, mix it up, change it up. There are thousands of grape varietals out there, tens of thousands of producers, and, you know, it's unfortunate that people just drink the same thing all the time. You know, as I say, we're supposed to be monogamous in one part of our life, but certainly when it comes to food and wine, we have the opportunity to explore and should do that and feel great about it.
And, you know, you mentioned just a few moments ago about the wine tasting. If someone does find themselves in wine tasting country or in vineyard mm-hmm. country, do you suggest they actually, you know, take the time and go on a wine tour?
I always like going in on my own rather than part of a group. I think sometimes you can get a little bit more personal attention. You know, these places are commonly staffed by people who are very passionate, very knowledgeable, and it's a wonderful opportunity to hone your skills and, you know, to have somebody work with you a little bit. So, you know, popping in tastings room, sometimes you may have to call and schedule an appointment, but that's not hard to do, and it can be really delightful. So I think it's great to do the big bus tours. Never really been a big fan of those. The one thing where they are very successful is that you will not be drinking and driving. And I think that's very important. So you want to sort of manage, you know, how many places you're going to go and what can you responsibly do.
Tommy, what do you say to people? Because I think, you know, the pervasive attitude, and I'm hoping it's changed in the last, you know, 10 years or so, but I think a lot of people feel just intimidated in the grand scheme of things, you know, with the art of wine, and that they're scared, you know, they don't want to pretend to be something that they're not, or elitist or pretentious. Right. What do you tell people, you know, who just really need to dip their toe in?
You know, there's several very good books out which do a great job of providing some basic education. I'm actually starting an educational series on my website for just this reason, you know, to really take people from the very beginning, assuming nothing, and over the next few years, we'll really drill it down. I've spent, you know, 15 to 20 years doing this, and it's something that I really enjoy. But, you know, for people who want to get a book maybe today, right away, Kevin Zarali has a book that's Z-R-A-L-Y called The Windows on the World Complete Wine Course, and that is the best beginning book that I know of. You know, I think that's a great place to start, but the other thing is to simply go out and to start tasting wine and start reading about it, and the main thing is to remember this should be fun. So the intimidation that we feel, I think, is unfortunate, but largely due to some of the unfortunate people that were representing the world of wine for some time, that, you know, were a little bit mean, a little bit cruel, would use their knowledge in an effort to make people feel uncomfortable. And I'm proud to say that most of those people, fortunately, have been run out of the business today. This is an area that many of us go to relax, to enjoy, to share with friends, to provide a little bit of levity, or maybe to add some beauty to our lives. And so wine should always be fun. You know, this isn't right and wrong. It's not surgery. It's really just food and wine, and we should just keep it at that level and have some fun with it.
Tommy, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
That's food and wine expert and host of the web series Gastro Tommy, Tommy Powers. Make sure to check him out, www.gastrotommy.com.
Bring on the remix.
My bad, but you know what I'm thinking. I lose my filter when I'm drinking. Only got one thing on my mind. No point in lying, I'm trying to make you mine. You need a little more convincing. It's all good cause I'm persistent. Baby, you got me tripping. Let's spend quality time and just kick it. You got me in the zone. Yeah, you're in a league of your own. I just need you to know that you had me, yeah, hello.
Oh, it's alright, I'm getting busy. Just enjoy the party. It's okay with me if you don't have that much to say.
Oh, that pretty much does it for this very special edition of the Kelly Alexander Show, and I want to give a big shout out to my technical producer Esteban Vargas for doing such great work as per usual. And I would like to leave you with a positive quote of the week, this time from Marianne Radmacher. Live with intention, walk to the edge, listen hard, practice wellness, play with abandon, laugh, choose with no regret, continue to learn, do what you love, live as if this is all there is. Have a great week. Any comments or questions, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.